I've done it with you by being intimate. You're a strong character. You displace a great deal of energy in the cosmos. Each individual displaces a certain amount of energy, some more than others, depending on the individual's makeup. A loud, excitable person's nervous system vibrates constantly, displacing energy into space. You could compare this to burning calories. All emotions, anguish, jealousy, fear, pleasure have their energy displacing devices. Peace, love, joy, are vibrations. Anger and pain use a different frequency level. When you say a person displaces energy, do you mean we generate it with our bodies? Yes. That force around you, the aura, is absorbed from the cosmos. Let me give you an example of how this force operates on a practical level. Let's say one day you're on a street and there's an automobile accident. A child gets trapped under the wheels of a car. As soon as the mother sees the situation, she runs to the rescue and picks up the front end of the car, freeing the kid. Many times, under certain circumstances, you gain extraordinary strength and energy, giving you the ability to do things you normally couldn't do. In this case, the desperate mother lifts 150 times her own weight, which is mathematically and seemingly physically impossible. The chemical responses in her body changes, her heart beats faster, her lungs pump lots of oxygen, her whole nervous system generates tremendous amounts of electric shock throughout her entire body. At this given moment, she's a mass of energy. Then she runs, picks up the front of the car, and pulls the child to safety. If she had to do the same thing under normal conditions, she couldn't possibly do it. I know exactly what you mean, I said. Remember soft-hyphening that something like that happened to me when I was in college? Tell me about it, and we'll analyze it. I was involved in a lot of Vietnam peace demonstrators soft-hyphenations then. They weren't unusual, it was happening in colleges all over the United States and was typical of my generation. I'd been arrested several times while taking part in these demonstrations. On this particular day, as I left my mother's house, she warned me very sternly that if she had to bail me out of jail once more, I would be facing a lot of trouble. I assured her it would only be a peaceful demonstration and that there was nothing to worry about. As it turned out, the only peaceful thing about this demonstration was the name. As usual, things got out of hand. Before long, we were surrounded by policemen with tear gas, arresting people. The only escape route, the alley, was blocked by two police cars. I guess I feared my mother's wrath more than the police. I don't know how I got the strength to jump over the trunk of one of those police cars, but I did. That's simple, Charles, Rama said, smiling. Faith. You knew you could do it because you had to. Like the mother who lifts the car, you knew you could perform that miracle. At that split second, your leg muscles reacted in such a way that your whole nervous system, your thinking processes, and all of your body moves soft-hyphenments were part of a cosmic force outside of your body. That force gave your legs the strength and spring that enabled you to jump over that car. There is a passage somewhere in the Jewish Talmud that says a lesson learned with pleasure is a lesson remembered. If this were true, I knew I would probably remember everything Rama ever said to me. As she talked, she smiled, touching me frequently, her Annie soft-hyphen-mated face communicating her tender feelings for me. I said, Rama, when you mentioned I would be able to take my spirit out of my body, I was excited. But today, as I think about it, I'm still a little edgy about this whole thing. Would you please be more specific as to why we are doing this? She quickly responded, I'm doing it because I want you to understand your own spirit, and to be able to take it out of your body. You'll discover it has many benefits. It's an adaptation device which will make you more receptive, more aware. Then you'll be able to learn more quickly and grasp the concepts I will be teaching you. You'll be able to assimilate more information and make deductions faster and more accurately. Also, you'll develop the ability to read the minds of people around you, so that you know their intentions. You'll be able to develop your memory to a degree you never thought possible. Once you learn to astral project, to take your spirit out of your body, you and I will be able to stay in touch with each other telepathically. You'll see, It's going to be fun. You'll also be able to know you've found eternal life. Once you've developed these skills, acquiring this new gift, you'll be tempted to show the world. You'll want to share your knowledge with others. It's natural to have this reaction. But how can this happen? By mixing our spirits, our Ananas and Ananites, we have become one massive spirit. Do you remember in the Prophet, where Khalil Gibran writes, he was she and she was he, they were one. That's what we did. We merged our spirits into one mass of energy. You experienced new things. From this point on, whatever took you normally, let's say, 5 days to learn, you'll be able to learn in a day and a half now. Why are you doing this for me? Not that I'm being unappreciative, but why is it so important that I leave my body? Because of what I told you about the destruction coming to your planet. Millions of people are going to die. By taking your spirit out of your body, you'll be experiencing something similar to death. The difference is your body will stay in one place and your spirit will be out in the cosmos. You'll be able to return anytime you want to. Death will have no power over you. This is sort of preparation for physical death. It's something your churches should have been preparing you for. You're telling me astral travel will be sort of like dying? Yes, that's what I'm saying. Oh, boy, then I'm definitely taking a rain check on this. I have no desire to fool around with these kinds of things. Come on, Chaco, there's nothing to be afraid of. Lots of people do it. I can't think of any reason why you shouldn't. It's the same as being asleep. When you return to your body, you'll have a dreamlike effect, but you'll also have 100% understanding and conscious recall of what went on when your Ananas and Ananites were out of your body. I understand the concept, I just don't feel ready for it, somehow. I'm not sure I want to do it. Don't worry about it. I'll be with you, helping you. It's something like going into a self-trance. You must be totally relaxed and at peace with yourself. Rama, I insisted. Still don't understand why it's so blasted important to have my soul leave my body. Well, first of all, it'll save us lots of time. Instead of doing research and digging into encyclopedias, you'll be learning things while your body rests peacefully some software. In other words, if you want to learn about, let's say the bees, ants, or just about anything, the only thing you will have to do is to take your spirit out of your body and go wherever your place of learning is. Let me give you an example. Say you wanted to learn about intimacy in the life of bees, you'd take your spirit out of your body and go inside a beehive. You'd get much greater benefit from being there as an eyewitness, seeing how the bees work, than by reading about them. You would see, experience and even sense everything with your five senses as if you were actually a bee. Once you return to your body, your memory cells would have assimilated whatever you had learned by being inside the beehive. You're saying this energy, this soul of mine, would be as small as a bee? How could I be in a beehive and yet have my body sleeping somewhere else? You take your spirit for an outing and you see a bee flying nearby. Then you transport your Ananas so that you have another body. Ears, eyes, and all the senses. What happens to the bee? She lends her Ananites to your spirit. Together, your Ananas and her Ananites make one mass of spirit, one whole awareness. Your spirit has to absorb some of the sensations of the bee. It will be as though you yourself are a bee. You've heard about possession, right? Haven't you worked on several movies dealing with the subject of diabolical possession? When you astral travel, the phenomena is similar. Your spirit is very elastic, it can be as big as the universe or as small as one of the units we have discussed before. So possessing the mind of a bee wouldn't be too difficult. You can possess the mind of a bird, a fish, a dog, a horse, anything you wish, just as long as you have some living creature with sensing devices. When I astral travel, must I always possess the mind of a living creature in order to have full consciousness of what's going on? No. Not always. When you project both Ananas and Ananites together, your spirit will take human form at a distance, without a body. That would be your ghost or your phantom. At that time you'll have full awareness and the ability to feel, touch, smell and hear the surroundings of that mass of energy. There will be no need of possessing any living creature then. Your spirit will take human form at a distance without a body. Does this clarify it for you? It's still confusing. We're going to have to get this very, very clear. Don't worry, don't worry. I plan to convey this concept clearly before we do anything. When will we do it? We're going to do it today. Maybe this afternoon when we come back from the fair. And when we start doing it, I'll be giving you exact directions. We drove for a while in silence while I pondered the things Rama was saying. I thought about what it would be like traveling around in the body of a bird or traveling to the farthest planets in outer space. Rama, I want to ask you something, I said. You mentioned life on the sun. The sun is a world like any other, except that it's very big. There's no fire on its surface, no more than on the Earth or any other planet. In fact, even less, because it's a very old world and its cooling process is greater. The humanity living on the sun is similar to man on Earth. The only difference is people's weight and height, they're lighter and taller. They're also more advanced in knowledge than you people on Earth, or even than the people in my world. It may take you thousands of terrestrial years to fully learn what an average sun inhabitant knows about God as a third force. Where do they get their light from? The sun has its own self-ignited light, reflected by the light of the spirits. And it attracts its light from the other solar systems. What about the fire we see here? We sense heat from the sun, we see the light, and we can observe the sun in a color scope. We see flames. Where does all this come from? Imagine a huge magnifying glass in the universe. This magnifying glass is an atmospheric layer between the sun and the planets. It works something like this. The sun emits energy rays, and when they hit this atmospheric layer, they ignite into fire and light. At a given point in the universe, there is a cosmic layer between the planets and the sun. I'm going to draw it for you, because I don't want you to have any misconceptions about this. Mars, Jupiter, Earth. She used the pad of paper I kept handy whenever we were together to draw a picture of the sun's energy system. You're saying, then, that the sun is a planet as cold as the Earth, and that there's no fire on the surface? Right. Remember, there are many religions whose source of life and religious inspiration is the sun. The Incas, the Egyptians, Mayans, Aztecs, and many others have said that they were direct descendants of the sun. I studied that. Okay. When you study the ancient Peruvians his soft hyphen Dory, you'll read about Manco Capac. He's the man who is said to have founded the Inca Empire. He came out of Lake Titicaca and founded the city of Cuzco because his father, the sun, sent him to populate the earth. He said he was the son of the Sunday. When the ancient Peruvians saw the ufonauts coming in their flying saucers, clothed in the same color as the sun, with rays of fire, they thought these UFOs were actual sparks from the sun, and the people emerging from the spaceships were called Sons of the Sunday. When I was studying Peruvian history, I theorized that they called themselves the Sons of the Sun because they either claimed to have come from the stars or related to the stars in some way, I said. This makes a lot of sense after seeing the Nazca Plains, Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman, the Gate of the Sun at Tiahuanaco, and all the other unexplainable things I've seen. I think it's very possible the ancient Peruvians had contact with outer space people. Is it true? Yes, Chaco, they did. The same way Moses talked to Jehovah and Ezekiel talked to his ufonauts. Here they call them Wirukachipa, Chacamac, Antiqui, and a few other names we'll be revising as we go along. I recognize those names. These people were divinities that came from heaven. Many times they took human form. When you do your research, there's a man, W. Raymond Drake, who's written some very interesting books on this subject. Gods and Spacemen in the Ancient West is one. He gives lots of details dealing with the ancient Peruvian traditions and their ways of being in contact with the stars. Once you've read it, I'm sure you'll have no further doubts, especially about our activities. Have you ever spoken to this man? No, but his work is quite explicit and simple, like von Daniken's. You know, when it comes to writing a book, I really don't know whether or not I could handle it. Don't worry about it now, Guido. We're going to go to the fair, buy a few things, get some food, and when we get back, We'll go to the medicinal waters, have a picnic, and cook our food outdoors. In other words, just have fun. Chapter 9. The Education of a Non-Believer. The Final Phase. We arrived in Huangqiao shortly before noon. It was a beautiful day, the sun was shining. As usual for a Sunday, the town was filled with people. Rama and I went from one end of the fair to the other, taking about an hour to walk 5 city blocks. Again, I was amazed by the vitality of the city on Sundays. We explored as many places as we could find, looking at antiques, jewelry, artwork, clothing, shoes, food, auto parts, vegetables, livestock, you name it. There was something for everyone. Let's buy some food and a pot so we can cook outdoors when we get back, Rama suggested. This is something you must start learning now, because in a few years, when your world is stricken by famine, you should be able to grow your own vegetables. It'll give you a better chance for survival. Learning to do these little things now, how to cook outdoors, to balance your diet, what makes your body function better, is a good place to start. When you take care of your body, you're taking care of your spirit. I guess you're right, I said. Lots of religions tell you how to diet, what to eat, what not to eat. When you diet properly, your body functions better. It depends on how you eat, how you sleep. The kinds of food you eat organize the molecules of your atoms, which arrange and structure themselves into your physical body. When you eat grains, like corn, wheat, barley, the molecules of these grains rearrange in your system and distribute your atoms evenly. Your whole physical constitution begins to organize after the patch-soft-turn of the molecules in the grains you eat. How does that help the human body? 139. Your bone structure becomes stronger. Your fibers are stronger. Your whole nervous system works at an even pace, making you less excitable. If you eat carrots and lettuce, you help your optical nerves. If you eat beets, you improve your kidney function. When you drink milk, your digestive system is aided by coating the walls of your stomach. I've heard of macrobiotics and homeopathic dyes. They use the same principles. As we walked along, talking, a woman approached us with what looked like a Chinese wok, handmade from copper and very pretty. Without saying a word to each other, I knew Rama wanted me to buy it. I gave the woman some Peruvian currency and we continued on our way with our new copper wok. After a while, we stopped by a few produce markets, picking out vegetables and fish, exploring the fair as we did our shopping. I enjoyed the sight of so many thousands of people from all over the world in one small remote mountain area. The tourists were Oriental, American and Eurosoft-Pian, as well as native South Americans. The Sunday fair in Huangqiao, Peru, is very famous. Rama and I were like any other young couple. She looked like an ordinary American hippie tourist, Sir Soft-Ainly, not like someone from another planet or civil eyes a Soft-Shin. We walked together, sometimes holding hands, kidding each other, pulling each other along, and laugh Soft-Ing a lot. I liked being out in public with her. It struck me that her behavior was very ordinary, like any other human being on this earth. She was completely relaxed and content, yet it seemed she used every minute I spent with her to teach me something new and exciting. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we both decided it was time to get back. I began to feel a little anxiety again, because I knew when we got back to Akaya I had to make a decision, one that could change my life completely. There I was, scared out of my wits. But I'd given her my word that I would try it. And try it I would. It was an hour's drive back to Akaya, and as usual, Rama used the time for instruction. She had been right when she'd said I would begin to look forward to our mind-bending conversations. This time, she started preparing me for my first out-of-body trip. She began by explaining that light, which is the origin of life, is also the reason there is life on the Sunday. In this case, she said, light is not color, but an electrical frequency linking the physical body and the spirit. For the purpose of taking my spirit out of my body, she asked me to think of the light that connects the body to the soul as the silver cord. She emphasized the importance of finding this silver cord. This is the first step, she said. To find the silver cord in the light you have to be at peace, you have to be vibrating at the right frequency. To find it, you look straight into a point of light. It could be the light of a candle, the reflection of some object reflecting sunlight, a sunset, a light in the distance, any light will do. Once the brightest point has been found, you go into a semi-soft hyphen trance, seeing this light coming directly into your eye. By squinting your eyes, you can make it larger, thinner, or stronger. Between point A, your eyes, and point B, the sharpest point of light, you'll see rays coming towards you. They may be thick, they may be thin, they will even be broken in the middle. That interval is the distance between the sun and your eye, the distance between your eyes and a candle, which has slipped into darkness about 20 feet away from you. Between the two points is an atmosphere. The spirit is flexible, it can travel 20 feet, or it can travel between the sun and your eye, many times faster than the speed of light. I think I understand you so far, I said, noticing the light reflecting off the chrome of the Volkswagen. As I drove, I listened to her, letting my mind concentrate on my driving yet at the same time flow with the images her words created. My eye continued to catch those reflections, while Rama said, in order to find your silver cord, you'll have to look for it in one of these reflections. It's the thinnest and the brightest. Many times you'll lose sight of it, which doesn't mean it's disappeared. It just means that you won't see it at that point. But you'll sense it, because you're part of this electric frequency between the light and your eye. Many times the reflections between the sunset and the eye have a bridge between them, a tiny cord that comes straight at you. It'll be the brightest and the thinnest ray of light. When you find it, you'll know it in your heart. Don't tell me, yes, I've found it, just to please me, because you'll be cheating yourself out of eternal life. It's something you must find yourself. No one can help you. This is the God inside you. Remember when they told you man is made in the image of God? All right, this is it. When you find the silver cord, you've found eternal life. All right, I said, let's see if I understand. When you look for the silver cord, you find something like a thread of light between your eye and the light producing or reflecting object. Yes, in fact, some call it the golden thread instead of the silver cord. When I find it, what state will I be in, conscious or unconscious? Aha! That's a very good question. In order to find your silver cord, you must let your body go. It must be so relaxed that you go into a semi-trance. You need the same kind of concentration that goes into hypnotizing someone. I'm not going to hypnotize you, though. I gave you the directions. If you want to do it by yourself in the bathhouse, that's fine with me. You go in with your candle and find it. Then when you have it, you tell me and we'll take the next step. You mean sort of practice how to do it? Once you've got it, you'll be doing it automatically. It's like anything else in life: exercise, practice, drilling. This is the kind of practice your churches should have been teaching you when you were a child. Let me bring up an important point here, Rama. You remember Moses talking to Jehovah and telling him in the sixth commandment that having sex without Ma-Soft-Rij was a sin? According to that commandment, then, we committed a sin against God last night and are both going to hell for it, aren't we? I guess that's what they teach you in this miserable world of yours. Well, that's what I've learned from religion my whole life. I don't know why you've chosen me to write this book for you. I don't feel worthy of it. I'm a sinner. Well, what can I tell you? Can you try to make some sense out of this paradox that has created hang-ups about sex in lots of people on this planet? Every religion in the world tells you that fornication is bad. Okay, I guess what you're telling me is that if I speak in the name of Jesus, the Christ, that if I speak in the name of the same God of Moses, how is it we could have sinned and yet be good in the eyes of God? Good girl. I said, making fun of her. The Ten Commandments were given to Moses at a time when Jewish people had been slaves for ages. When those people came out of slavery, they were wild, like animals, with no conception of law and order. They were people without discipline, without cause. They had lost all hope. Therefore, Jehovah, the cosmonaut, decided to give them the Ten Commandments as a way of enforcing some laws and respect. In no way does Moses write about the sixth commandment as a way of saying that sex is bad. All he's saying is that if you want to have sex, you must secure something for the woman. It was a way to protect women, because in those days, women didn't know too much about women's liberation. What makes sex bad is the interpretation of individsoft-al religions, which has made sex dirty. These intersoft-pretations are a result of the way humanity in this world of yours has had the tendency to exploit sex, to make a business out of it. Women and sex were traded and used in negotiations like horses, flour, whiskey. Sick. Maybe you're right. I guess I shouldn't be ashamed of my avid interest in sex. No, you shouldn't be ashamed, because when you make love you do it for the pure joy and pleasure it gives you. You give yourself to the experience, you like the vibrations. It turns you on to see your women enjoying it. There's nothing dirty or bad about that. Then it's not a sin to be sexual? If it's done with the right spirit, it's a very soothing experience, something that makes your spirit vibrate at the right frequency. But Rama, I remember being told that you have to obey the Ten Commandments to save your soul or to go to heaven. Not anymore. Those commandments were given for a specific time in the life of the Jews, 3,000 years ago. You couldn't possibly live by them today. Jesus said nearly 2,000 years ago that in order to win the kingdom of eternal life, one must do only two things. What are they? Love God and love your fellow human beings. That way you understand God, you honor your parents, you don't kill anybody, you don't steal, don't bear false witness. I was punished as a child for even speaking about sex. So you can imagine how I feel about it. Now I do it very openly, but people get the wrong impression. But I never tried to hurt anybody. I always try to be sincere with the woman when it comes to the flesh. I sense that about you. That's why I chose to speak to you and why I want you to help us. Because there is no mean intent in you. Your intentions are clean and clear, even though you have this conflict within yourself about two sex. Well, what else do you expect with the type of upbringing I've had, the type of society of which I'm a part? That's why I'm telling you these things about your soft-self. The reason you feel so nervous and uptight about all this is because you have been conditioned to feel that way. I'm telling you now, Chaco, you'll never make it back to LA this week. You'll have some complications associated with your work that will detain you. We probably won't see each other for a while until this is resolved, so I want to give you some homework. I want you to read two books in the Bible, and I mean read them thoroughly. One is Daniel, the other is the whole book of Revelations. I also want you to read the 20-4th chapter of Matthew, the whole chapter. After you take your out-of-body trip, you'll learn so quickly that we won't have to look things up in the Bible. You will make your own comparisons about what is going on now and what's going to be happening in the coming years. You'll acquire plenty of knowledge by direct experience. I've enjoyed these little sessions with you. They've been very enlightening. So would you like to go into the water by yourself, relax, and try to find your silver cord? No, I'd like you to be there with me. To have your guidance if I'm going to go through with it. When we got to Akaya, we chose a pleasant spot to do our outdoor cooking. We had brought along the wok, a bottle of oil, some soy sauce and our fresh vegetables and lamb. We built a fire, cooked the meat in hot oil over the firewood and added the vegetables as the lamb simmered. Just before taking it off the heat, we added some onion. In less than an hour we had put together our whole meal. We feasted on bread, wine, lamb, vegetables and, for dessert, fruit. That night, as I was making preparations for the drive back to Lima, Rana said she would spend the night with me again if I decided not to go back until morning. That settled, I washed the wok in the river and went up to the hotel to get the keys to the bathhouse. I was in no big rush to get back to Lima that night. I now had two things to look forward to. My first out-of-body experience and sleeping with Rana again. When we went to the bathhouse, we lit a candle in preparation for my astral projection. Rana kept reminding me that I could need to concentrate and that the candle's light was to be the focus of that concentration. The big moment was here. We undressed and got into the water. Rana kept touching me reassuringly as she looked at me with her penetrating eyes.